Today, in week two of the series, Stories to Live By, we examine the power of the parables through the story of the tax collector and the Pharisee. Don't we all tend to have an inflated sense of self, deflated sense of God, or distorted sense of values? Are we often spiritual paupers? Here's Pastor Seth.
We're looking at some of the parables of Jesus. Parables are interesting things. Normally in our Western world, we like to know what are the principles. Lay out the teaching. Lay out the bullet points. And there are some times when Jesus did that, but there are a whole lot of times where he didn't do that. He told a story, a parable. Why would he do that? Parable is made up of a Greek word, a combination word, a prefix and a root word. The prefix is para, which means alongside of, and balan, which means to throw. Kind of to throw alongside. Throw alongside, hoping somebody will catch it. I remember when my son was about 4 or 5 years old, we started going outside and playing catch. The first time we started playing catch, I'd, hey, Cole, throw him the ball. Not very good at catch. But we kept at it until it came to the point where he caught the ball. And then it became fun for him. Throw the ball. Throw it to me again, Dad. Caught the ball. Oh, and Jesus told didactic proofs, teaching. Is it easy for human nature to go, yeah, I've heard that before. Got that. Okay. I was hoping to hear something new today. In other words, they didn't catch it. But a parable has the ability not just to enter into someone's head, but to make its way down into the heart and resonate. And something down there goes, bing, in a different way that a didactic teaching won't. I suspect that part of it is we identify with one of the people in the parable, and we don't identify with some of the other people. The power of a parable, when I think of this, it sort of acts like a mirror. Sort of acts like a mirror. We may have heard a certain truth for years and years and years, but when we see it in story form, suddenly, ding, light bulb goes off. In our particular culture, over the last 40 years I've lived as an adult, it seems to me that our culture, as it drifts farther and farther away from God, is moving closer and closer to valuing self as the highest value. Christopher Latch, in his book, The Culture of Narcissism, has this quote. He says, to live for the moment is the prevailing passion. To live for yourself, not for your predecessors or posterity. He's talking about Americans. He sees this general trend towards the passion to live for yourself, not for your predecessors, like you see in the Eastern world, or your posterity, which you see sometimes in Western world, in particular families. Dave Myers is a psychologist, and he did a study of high school students. And he came up with, after studying, doing a survey of high school students, he came up with a phrase that sort of summed up his findings of the high school mentality, and it was this: the inflated self. The inflated self. Now, he went into the study sort of assuming that what he was going to hear was a bunch of high school seniors that in their honest moments were going to talk about low self-esteem and feeling bad about themselves and trying to prop themselves up and feel better about themselves. And much to his surprise, he found that those things were only symptoms of the real problem, which was an inflated sense of self. Let me give you two statistics that he found. He asked the high school seniors to rate themselves in general. Do you see yourself, compared to other high school seniors, as below average, average, or above average? And 0% said below average. Think about that. 0% below average. And then the second one that was pretty striking to me was, 60% of the high school seniors rated themselves in the top 10% of the ability to get along well with others. Think about high school drama. 60% rated themselves in the top 10%. What he realized was something alongside of what Jesus would say. The less that God is central in our life, and the more we make self central in the effort to try to prop up self, then that's going to be sort of the driver of our life. But the offshoots of that are going to be all kinds of negative things that we have to deal with. For example, one of them is blindness to our blind spots or our weaknesses. We are very hesitant to receive feedback or constructive criticism from anybody. Think about the last time somebody gave you some feedback or constructive criticism. How well received was that? You're overreacting. You're taking it out of context. I'm not like that. Are the things that just come gurgling out of us like water at a water fountain. We are blind to our weaknesses. There was an elderly wife who was home doing some chores, and she was listening to the radio, and she suddenly heard here in the Southland that there was a driver driving on the 405 going the wrong way. And she knew her husband, Harold, was driving on the 405. He was on his way home. She ran over and picked up her cell phone. She said, "Harold," he picked up the phone while he's driving, "Harold, I just heard on the news there's some idiot out there driving the wrong way on the 405. Be careful." And he said, "One? Why, there's hundreds of them." Blind. The second thing we'll find is you're going to find within yourself the urge to have things your way, your idea, how it ought to be done, how something should be done, or to have to be right, or to have to be the first person that thought of this idea. You will find, I think paradoxically, a rise in anxiety, which it seems in my just very casual observation, that the more that we sort of elevate self, and then the fourth one I observe is how critical we can be. Whenever we're trying to, without even knowing it, prop up self, one of the ways that our fallen heart does that is to sort of put other people down in our hearts. Now, most of the time we think about being critical, we can think of that person over there or in your extended family that's way, but you probably don't think about yourself in terms of being critical. But let me tell you the kinds of things that went through my mind this past week while driving. Doesn't this lady know that's driving in front of me that if she goes this slow, we're not going to make the green light? We could make the green light if you would hurry up. Come on, come on. Oh, we didn't make the green light. Anybody ever try to turn left on Irvine Center Drive here to come to church? You're coming over from Sand Canyon. Anybody try to do that? Yeah. At lunch, I come that way usually. The light is, the left-hand light is short. If the first person there is not on their cell phone, four of us can make it through. Not five, four. There are times when I am the fourth one in line, trying to see if the first person up there is on their cell phone. Don't you know that if you're the first one in line at the light, that you should be looking at the light and not on your cell phone? Critical. How come it always has to be her way? Why does it always have to be the way he wants to do it? Critical. What's going on there? The less I am depending on God for my value at any given moment, the more natural those things are going to seem. And then being critical is sort of like a teeter-totter. If I finally get so sick of being critical towards others, then I start being critical about me. What am I doing? Humble, goes down here. Then I start the process all over again. Critical towards others, critical towards me. Critical towards others, critical towards me. Now, it's with this background that we look at the parable Jesus told to a group called the Pharisees. A bunch of the epitome of religiosity in Judaism. Luke 18:9. He told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Here's the setting of the parable. To those who trusted in themselves, and the Greek reads, that this was spoken of, reads something like this: those who decided that they were the judges and arbiters of their own goodness. Not God, themselves. Today we would say something like, well, no, I'm not perfect, but I'm a pretty good person. That's who the parable is addressed to, people like us. Now, there are two people in this parable. The first is the Pharisee, which I think of as the performer. The performer. Luke, he starts the parable. Two men went up into the temple to pray. That was the objective, or at least that was the spoken objective, to pray. One a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. Now, a Pharisee, in our particular day and age, is a synonym for hypocrite, or somebody who's an extreme rule keeper, and sort of loses sight of people and love and those kinds of things. Pharisee. Somebody mean and critical you don't want to be like. But 2,000 years ago, Pharisee was kind of the pillar of the community. Looked up to and esteemed and revered as a religious fellow and somebody whose example we should follow. Ironically, the Pharisees were the people who lost sight of the purpose of the Old Testament story. The Old Testament story was not about, tell me what right religious things I'm supposed to do, and then watch how I do them. Old Testament was there to tell us, oh my gosh, look at all the things I'm supposed to do and supposed to be, and I'm not. Something in me needs fixing. Well, the Pharisees were about as far from that as they could be. Went up to the temple and prayed. Verse 11. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus, and then look what Jesus says next about this man. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. Now, the Greek could also be translated to himself or for himself. And the idea is, instead of a prayer being the expression of a God-centered person, what you see is this is the expression of a self-centered person, a self-centric rather than God-centric person. He prayed thus with himself. And here's the prayer. God, I thank thee that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. What stands out to you, what stands out to me as I think about this, is that here's a man who is no question is devoutly religious, but is devotedly self-centric. Devoutly religious, devotedly self-centric. And that's being exposed in the light of this parable. If you look at that prayer, you're not going to find anything in there about praise to God or anything about thanksgiving. You're not going to find prayers for other people. All you're going to hear is sort of self-congratulatory, aren't I such a good boy? Look at all that I do. Now, this particular man, as Jesus talked about in other places about the Pharisees, was driven by two things. And that is to be impressive and to feel just a little bit more superior than you. Not a whole lot, just a little. It's like we are, impressed and superior. He said, I fast twice a week. The Old Testament told the people to fast once a year. Pharisees normally fasted once a week. This guy's got nothing on me. Twice a week, hey. I give tithe of all that I get. People are supposed to tithe all their income. This guy's tithing not only on his income, but his birthday gifts that come in. And his gift cards to Starbucks, he's tithing on those. I thank thee I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, people that are on their cell phone when they shouldn't be in the car. who aren't turning on their blinker when they're in a parking lot to let you know you could go. But no, we've got to wait for God to make the turn first. Comparison. Not that yours truly ever thinks things like that. Paul says, not that we venture to class or compare ourselves to one another, as some of those who commend themselves. Let's go to that next verse. But when they measure themselves by one another and compare themselves with one another, they are without understanding. Foolish. The terrible thing about comparison is that if I compare myself to people who, in my estimation, do less than me, then I feel superior. And that has consequences, as we've talked about at the beginning of this message. If I compare myself to those who are farther ahead of me, I get discouraged and want to give up. He says, you're without understanding. Either way, you lose. Now, as we think about the performer, I think about three just general things that strike me about this guy. The man had an inflated sense of self. An inflated sense of self. Sort of like a balloon. Blew up the balloon. Bigger, 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 bigger. Hardly even knew what was going on. At the same time, he had a deflated sense of God in his life. Now, it's not that he didn't know God, and he wasn't at the temple to ostensibly talk to God, and he sort of built his life around the value of God, but in his heart was a very different thing. Inflated sense of self, deflated sense of God in his heart, and a distorted sense of values. Distorted sense of values. What we heard him pray was the things that he didn't do, and then a couple things that he did do. What was exposed is who the man really was. And he seemed to be blind to himself. It was almost like you're looking at a facade. When I was in junior high, my parents took us on a family vacation from Denver. We went up, saw the Teton Mountains for the first time. It's pretty spectacular. Yellowstone National Park, over to Yosemite, San Francisco, down to L.A. Now, one of the places we went was is one of those Hollywood studio things. Now, this is so long ago. I think it was Universal. But don't think Universal like it is now. And we went on one of those tram rides through. And some of you that are old enough to remember these shows, we went on some of the sets where they filmed Leave It to Beaver and The Lone Ranger, PT-109. And I remember thinking, man, we're going to get to see all these places we watch on TV. So we're in the tram and we're going up the Leave It to Beaver Street. And man, I could see the front of the house. Big two-story house right there. See the green grass out front, the white picket fence, all the shrubbery up there. I'm thinking, wow. Then as we get up, I can see in the window. And in the window, there's nothing except the facade. That's all it is. And then you can see these massive 2x4s holding this thing up so it wouldn't fall over. And I remember thinking, but that's not where Beav and the Wally live. June doesn't pick up this house. Where's Ward's chair where he reads the newspaper in his coat and tie? I was mortified. Then we went over to the PT-109 set. Now this, how many of you know what have ever seen PT-109? Okay, all right, there are like six of us. Okay. All right, let me tell. PT boat is like the littlest Navy boat in World War II. Fast, you know, went everywhere. Tons of these things everywhere. And so there is this base in the South Pacific. Ernest Borgnine and Tim Conway, and it's sort of this a bunch of guys that always screw up the mission, and somehow it comes together and they drive their commanding officer crazy. Well, there are plenty of scenes where it looks like they're on the PT boat and they are racing across the South Pacific to some island. Wind is blowing, hair is going, guns are blazing. We go up to the PT-109 set. There's a little pond I say pond, I'm being generous. A little pond, and there was a little platform. That was the boat. That was PT-109. I went home shattered. I did. It feels like my whole childhood evaporated right in front of me. That is the picture of the Pharisee, the performer, who without even knowing it is trying to elevate himself in the eyes of the other people just a little bit more than them so he can feel better about himself. And you don't have to be religious to do this. You could be just as irreligious and do the very same thing. That's the first person in our parable. The second person I think of as the pauper, or here the spiritual pauper, as opposed to the performer. Pauper, of course, is the fellow that knows he has nothing. Verse 13. But the tax collector. Tax collectors back then were seen with more disdain than they are seen today. I've been audited 3 times. Thankfully, it's been a long time since the last one. And of the 3 audits, I think I paid a total of $100 on the 3 of them. The last one, the auditor said, "Mr. Gatchel, when I look at all your records and stuff, I have no idea why you're here." Well, that's good to know. But when I went in the first time, I was petrified, man. I had all my records and my receipts and everything written out. Back then, it was worse. These guys in the Roman Empire were given the task of collecting a certain amount of quota, a certain amount of revenue for their area. And Rome didn't care how they got it. All we want is that number at the end of the year. Whatever you take over that, that's up to you. Well, as you can imagine, that made for a lot of fraud and theft. I'll try not to say anything more about taxes. Move on. The tax collector. He's standing far off. Remember, this guy went to pray too. What you notice here is something about his position. He's sort of off in the shadows. It's almost like, I don't even know if I should come. Well, of course he should. But there's something about him that standing far off, and then you see something about his posture. Jesus said the guy wouldn't even lift up his eyes to heaven. And he says he beat his breast. That's a pretty vivid picture, isn't it? You have this picture in your imagination? You see this guy? Your imagination, standing off to the side, over in the shadows, kind of face down like this. And then we see his prayer. "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." That's it. That's his prayer. Not very impressive. We wouldn't even call it a formal prayer. I don't know if anybody's ever gotten up to pray in the 30 years almost of our church and prayed that prayer. In fact, it almost doesn't sound like a prayer. It more sounds like there's just something guttural coming up deep within him, just like well water that's just sort of coming up to the surface and just sort of just throwing it out there as a request. What you don't hear is a bunch of tripe and excuses. "Well, I know I shouldn't have been harsh with my wife, but she was on me all week, and you can't blame me for what I said, can you?" "Well, God, you don't expect me to keep that promise after all I've been through lately." "Well, I told him I was gonna contribute that amount, but you know, in light of what's happened to us, nobody would hold me to that." "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." Now, what's fantastic about this is that the guy's prayer, as short as it was straight to the point. And it's exactly what he needed, mercy. I remember in junior high, one of the events for junior high boys on Friday afternoon was fight up on the hill. who are the two guys that were mad at each other? They're going to pummel each other. And we all went down there, and maybe 25 or 30 made a big circle, and these two guys would go at it, and we'd be cheering one for one for the other guy. Mostly grateful that I wasn't the one in the middle fighting. I was a little guy, a really short guy. I think that's probably where I've learned that I may look stupid, but I don't have to be stupid. Might have been birthed there. And the fight would go on until one of the guys was on the ground, and he would yell, "Uncle," which at that point meant mercy. Meaning, there's no chance of me winning. I'm done. This is only going to get worse from here. Please, though you have it all in your power to punish me more, I'm begging you, stop. Mercy. And thankfully, he's at the exact place where the mercy seat is, in the Holy of Holies, where the blood is sprinkled of an innocent for the guilty. And where one day this man's sins will fall on someone else's shoulders and be carried off, never to be seen again. Quite a picture. I think what strikes me about this prayer at the end, "Be merciful to me, a sinner." Not like he did, "Man, I had two things I screwed up on this week. I'm such an idiot." No. There's something he realizes that's much bigger, deeper problem in him, and that is his propensity to keep going his way, have things his way, keep making things about him, keep creating drama, all about me, that will just never get fixed on his own. Now, Jesus finishes the lesson, and he contrasts these two guys and the effect of living this way. Verse 14, "I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other," tax collector. He looks at the prayer of the tax collector, "God be merciful to me, a sinner," and he just goes like, "Yes! The guy's got it! Eureka!" Now, it's interesting to me what Jesus says and what he doesn't say. This man went down to his house justified. Now, we use that term, the world does, to justify ourselves or our position or our sin. But the biblical term for justify is to be justified in the sight of God. And the way that happens is, and it only happens this way, as the New Testament tells us, is that we are declared righteous. A decision in heaven has been made. In response to the cry for mercy, we are declared righteous. He doesn't say that the man was made righteous. As you and I know, and one of the reasons why we're here, we got a long way to go in the making of ourselves as righteous people. And one of the paradoxes about being a Christian is that the more progress I think I'm making in that direction, it seems like the goal keeps getting farther and farther away from me. Not made righteous. I doubt he felt righteous. And I would highly doubt that he felt closer to God. Probably not necessary. It might take away from the wonder of being declared righteous and all that mercy involves with that. Well, this is what the gospel is. Romans 3:24. All are justified freely. Freely. By his grace. Unmerited favor. Through redemption that came by Christ Jesus. But that's not what the Pharisee was going to receive. Romans 10:3 is a description of him. Since they did not know the righteousness that comes from God, that we could be declared righteous if we humbled ourselves, saw our sin, and came to God in humility and said, "I am a sinner through and through. I need forgiveness. Please have mercy on me." They're not going to do that. Why? They sought to establish their own. "I can do it. I'm a good person. I can do better." They did not submit to God's righteousness. They didn't experience that. And then he says, at the end of this, he says, verse 14, the last part of verse 14, "Everyone who exalts himself," meaning the Pharisee, times when we're trying to feel just a little bit more superior than my wife or my son or my daughter or my friend or my next door neighbor or the driver in front of me or the driver next to me. Everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. This man's prayers were worthless, religion meaningless to him, gave him absolutely no help, and his congratulations were like a silent clap. Now, before we close, I hope none of us will think about, okay, I see the prayer I'm not supposed to pray, and I see the prayer I am supposed to pray. Got it. That's not the point of the parable. The point of the parable is to expose the two men's hearts. The hearts of the two men. When I think about this as we wrap up in your handout, how am I supposed to live? What does this parable tell me about as I walk out the door and enter life again? There are two things. Yes, I am a sinner by nature. No surprise. I'm going to go my way, left to myself, every time. On my own, helpless to change, but also, number two, a fully forgiven and restored child of God to be seated at the Father's own banquet table, ready someday. Ready for me someday. Now, what's he saying here? If not in my head, but in my heart, I look at point number one, in my heart, and I humble myself and say, yes, just like the tax collector, I am a sinner by nature, on my own, helpless to change. Mercy, the more that my heart embraces that and says, that's me, the deeper I go with that, the stronger number two moves from just my head to change how I look at myself and how I live my life and how I relate to the people in my life. As a restored child of God, ready to be seated at God's banquet table someday that's been prepared for me. The opposite of moping around going, oh, what's wrong with me? How can I still snuck with all this sin? Now, the Pharisee's approach is the opposite. He looks at point number one and he says, oh, no, no, no. Don't you point that at me. Don't tell me I could be doing better at this. Don't tell me I had a bad attitude. Don't give me that kind of feedback. You're overreacting. The more that happens, the more I diminish point number one, the less point number two makes any sense at all to me. I may look at point number two and go, oh, that's a really good thought, Seth. Thanks for... I'll look at that this week. Really, the heart, you could say, is my self-centric person or a God-centric person. It's a question about the heart. And there it is. Inside that heart, there's a lock and a key. What's really going on in there? Am I driving the car? It's God driving the car. Am I in charge? I know what to do. Pretty good. Just watch me. Now, inside that heart, there's a chair. We call it a throne. That throne was meant for God. And if he sits on that throne, I seem to do better than when I put myself on that throne. I got to tell you, every day of every week, of every month, of every year, I keep trying to put myself on that throne. And that's a bad idea. What I've learned, and still learning after all these years, is that God is God, and I am not. Let's pray together. Father, I fear that we will just hear this parable and say, Lord, I thank you that I'm not like this Pharisee. Our list of things that we don't do like others do, and our list of things that we do do, and miss what you're trying to say to our hearts. To open up our hearts and expose who really, really, really is sitting in that throne. Father, would you help us just to humble ourselves? Say, God, thank you for being merciful to me, a sinner. And I gladly, delightedly yield myself to you. Why would I do anything else than that? Once again, receive me as a child, a little child, simply by faith and trust in your promises. And do your good work in me to change me from a self-centric person to a Jesus-centered person.